Coming up on Golf Today, great buddies, great players, and a great win for Rory and Shane in New Orleans. Wait till you see the celebration. A little beer, a little karaoke, and a whole lot of fun. How about a 15-year-old Miles Russell stopping by fresh off back-to-back starts on the Korn Ferry Tour? What's it like playing and playing well against the pros? And what is next? From one kid to another, David McClay Kid joins the show as his baby, Bandon Dunes, turns 25 years old this week. Put the candles on the cake. It's Golf Today.
Golf Today.
It's Golf Today on a Monday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. We've both been to New Orleans, Louisiana. I tell you what Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry did looked like the ultimate buddies trip itinerary.
And like most buddies trips, it ended, I suspect, with a pretty good hangover. I think I might be the only Irish golfer who doesn't have a hangover today. Shane Lowry's a dangerous guy to be around, at least for your liver, if he's got a trophy in his hands.
No question about it. In case you missed it, over the weekend, these two guys were making their tournament debut as teammates at the Zurich Classic of New Orleans. Longtime buddies, there they are, hugging it out. Rory and Shane defeating Chad Ramey and Martin Traynor on the first playoff hole at TPC Louisiana. Look at those heavyweight belts. They were like Tyson and Holyfield getting the job done.
And with this win, Rory McIlroy logs his 25th victory on the PGA Tour in 247 starts. That's enough to tie him with Tommy Armour, Johnny Miller, and McDonald Smith for 23rd on the all-time wins list. Lowry gets his third victory in 174 starts, his first since the Open Championship in 2019. And as you'd expect, afterwards, they did a little bit of celebrating. You know, I'm just waiting for Greg Norman to tweet that they're just imitating Liv Adelaide at this point.
That was some party. And listen, you know, Journey, Don't Stop Believing, that's a top five karaoke song, in case you don't know. And I want to say this. I remember talking to Rory years ago when he turned 30. He said he wanted his 30s to be better than his 20s. And there's still time for him. He turns 35 on Saturday. He may not get there from a major championship standpoint. The one green jacket might change that conversation. But my goodness, he's become a father, another FedEx Cup title, a great Ryder Cup in Rome. And to see him with one of his best friends in the game, standing on a stage, enjoying a win in the Zurich Classic of New Orleans, you know, it looked like a lot of fun. Rory looked loose, fancy free, and I think he had a lot of fun last week, clearly.
That's what distinguishes this win for me more than anything else. You know, we can argue over whether team victories are as meaningful or should be counted in the same way as individual victories, but it was the fun factor in there, because so much of what you see on the PGA Tour week to week is the individual pressure. In Rory McIlroy's case, you've seen the dreary weight of political infighting on his shoulders a lot as well. He hasn't had a particularly good year since he won in Dubai in January. Shane hasn't had a particularly good year either, and this is enormous for Shane Lowry. This gets him into the next three signature events on the PGA Tour that Rory McIlroy was already in. So it does have a very significant impact on the rest of Shane Lowry's year. And to me, the fun factor was the big part of it. They looked like two guys who were enjoying themselves away from the dreariness of individual competition and the pressure of individual competition. And it was kind of fun to see Shane Lowry trying to pick Rory up. Well, it would have been more fun to see Rory pick Shane up on the 18th
hole. Don't hurt his back.
We haven't seen Shane manhandle Rory since that car park in Rome when he was getting into it with Bones.
How about that? Those two often put their best golf together. Third PGA Tour win for Shane Lowry and a 25th PGA Tour win for Rory McIlroy. Let's continue the conversation with the Golf Today Roundtable and welcome in our good buddies from GolfDigest.com, contributor Shane Ryan and Golf Digest senior writer Joel Beal. Great to see you guys. Happy Monday. Joel, you wrote a game story. You know, you kind of posit the question, is this as good as it gets for the Zurich Classic of New Orleans? What do you think? As good as it gets, or is maybe this victory maybe a launching point, an identity for this team event on the PGA Tour?
Yeah, nice feathers to put in the Zurich's cap. Not that just Rory was involved, but that he was in a pairing that made sense and it was an easy sell to fans. But I do think what we saw is the dream scenario. And if McIlroy and Lowry aren't involved, I mean, all due respect to those who are on that leaderboard, but that was not exactly a board that gets people fired up at home, at least the casual fans, right? That's sort of been the theme since the Zurich has went to this format 8 years ago. Occasionally you have a name winner, but most of the field is comprised of the rank and file. You know, I think team golf has a part in the future of whatever the professional game looks like. The problem is, I think we continue to look at the Ryder Cup as what team golf could be. And don't get me wrong, the Ryder Cup is golf at its best, but the team component is just a small reason why. If the team component was the main thing, you would see LIV have success with their format. And even the tour should know this too, that would not, the President's Cup hasn't really reached the heights that the President's, or the President's Cup hasn't reached the heights that the Ryder Cup has. So I applaud the creativity for trying this format. I just like to see the creativity in maybe a men's or women's mixed event, or even just the return of match play. But for me, the team format just doesn't quite do it.
Shane, are you on board with what the rewards are for this tournament, in that each player gets 400 FedEx Cup points, which are really the currency that matters on the tour these days? That's more than Billy Horschel got for winning an opposite field event the previous week, although Billy was on our show last week and thought the team event should actually even have more points than the 400. But it gets Shane Lowry into the next three signature events. Are you happy with what the actual benefits are for winning an event where you're hitting, in theory, half the shots?
Yeah, I'm more than happy. Look, and I don't know why Joel Beal seems to hate fun. You know, this is just a little bit of novelty on the PGA Tour schedule. I think it's a good time. And look, I mean, I've seen debates recently about Sam Snead versus Tiger Woods. You know, every time Sam Snead played a practice round, they gave him an official PGA Tour victory. I think it's okay. I think it's okay to have a little bit of fun, a little bit of difference. Look, these guys, you saw Rory, you know, singing afterward. It produced a good result. Maybe it's not always going to be the best leaderboard, but I'll tell you what, no tournament at this part of the schedule would have produced a good leaderboard, right? We're going to probably see it at the Byron Nelson too. It doesn't matter that it was team golf, really. For me, I think anything you can do differently. Now, I agree with Joel that I would love to see match play brought back. That's kind of like my baby. That's my favorite thing. But yeah, give these guys, like, have a little bit of a change on the schedule. Give them the full rewards. They still had to win a tournament together. There is still an art to playing as a team. I think anytime we can have something like this, it's a little bit of fun, so why not?
Joel, what do you think? 25 wins for Rory McIlroy, or is it 24 and a half? Some thought maybe that 25th win would come at, you know, down the street at Augusta National, or maybe at Jacksonville at the Players. A 25th win at the Zurich Classic, is it hollow, or is it fully, completely baked and should be completely embraced by all of us?
Yeah, winning's hard enough. There's been... especially now the way the game is set up, both with how deep it is and just the current equipment that kind of raises the level of just the middle class to, when they're playing good, can play even better. I'm certainly not in the business of taking away a win from somebody. This was a trophy well earned by Rory.
Shane, there was a LIV event in Adelaide at the weekend as well, which obviously had a team component to it. It's constantly cited by the LIV guys as their most successful stop and as evidence that there's a market there for a global tour, a global presence that they say the DP World Tour, the PGA Tour, has ignored. They conveniently leave out that it's a government-subsidised tournament and that it's LIV's pockets that are actually funding it, because the DP World Tour proves year after year there is no commercial support for elite golf at that level in many corners of the world, including in Australia. Do you buy the argument, though, that there is still a gap in the schedule here that needs to be filled by either the PGA Tour or the DP World Tour in terms of being a presence in places that have been kind of ignored over the last decade or so?
Well, first of all, I've always been on record as saying that I think at tournaments like these, we should be allowed to throw full water bottles at players and caddies. So I like that element of it. But no, to answer your question seriously, I think, like you said, there is one tournament being held in Australia. It is kind of like this indigo child of all tournaments, where there's government subsidies, they get everybody in there, they can kind of pump it up as this big event. But it is in no way representative, Eamon, as you said, even of Australia, much less the corners of the world where they go, where pretty much nobody is interested in golf, and they can't get big crowds, and things look pretty anemic, where there's basically nobody watching these guys on the fairway. So it's almost like a Potemkin village that they're putting up here in some ways, where it's like, yeah, we create this big raucous atmosphere. The people there are clearly having a good time, and that's fun, and I have no problem with that. But in terms of the sustainability of it, absolutely not. This is not some kind of like canary in a coal mine or a harbinger of things that could be to come. This is a one-time thing that they can pull off exactly once a year with the help of the Australian government. And for me, that's where it begins and ends until proven otherwise, which I don't think they've done.
A little bit of a Truman Show vibe at LIV Golf Adelaide, according to our buddy Shane Ryan. Much more ahead. Part two of this roundtable will tackle Equity Grants and Scottie Scheffler, Nelly Korda. Much more on this Monday edition of Golf Today. We are back right after this.
We're back in Golf Today, continuing our conversation with the Vidal and Buckley of Golf Digest here, Shane Ryan and Joel Beal. Joel, I want to go back to you on the equity grants that PGA Tour Enterprises, the new for-profit face of the game, announced to players last week. Each player who was going to get this grant given in confidence the details of how much that is worth. Do you think this is the kind of program that is going to head off some complaining from players that, you know, this is as good as it's going to get in terms of the reward, and if you want more, you build on it? Or do you think it's going to be a little bit of complaining about who else got awards that they don't think ought to get awards?
Yeah, I don't think this is a solution at all. And it's sadly ironic that the powers that be try to answer the problem by throwing money at it, because money is sort of what got the game in the pickle it's in right now, right? But yeah, it's unlikely the solution, just because we're talking about greed, self-preservation, entitlement. Those are not financial issues, right? Those are issues of the heart, and no dollar sign fixes that. I think eventually that sense of privilege returns, and no matter what equity you give, that's just no appeasing it. To me, the bigger problem is we're now 3 months into this SSG partnership, and we've yet to hear how this will improve the product for fans. I like to think the game's stakeholders understand that the fan base is aggrieved, that they're frustrated and fed up, that real change needs to come rather soon, but that just hasn't been communicated yet. So I think that's important, because if golf fails to rebuild its relationship with the fans, I mean, this equity is going to be worthless.
On that note, Shane, we have these incredible stories on the PGA Tour and LPGA. Nelly Korda's won five straight starts. Scottie Scheffler's won four of his last five starts. Are those stories cutting through to people that you speak to, maybe the casual golf fan, the big-time sports fan, or is it because of the fractious nature of the professional game over the last couple of years that these great storylines are being lost and that people don't care as much as they should?
It's such an interesting question, because the golf crowd that I run with, like my friends that I'm playing golf with, they do admire and appreciate Scottie Scheffler, and especially after he won the Masters, I think that cut through to a certain extent. But then you look at the TV ratings, it's clearly down from there. And you sort of talk to people who are more casual, who aren't, you know, playing golf two times a week. It doesn't seem like Scheffler would cut through much in that sense. As far as Nelly Korda, I think it's even a little bit tougher, not just because of the differences in viewership in the men's and women's game, but because I don't think it's a big secret that Nelly Korda really doesn't like dealing with the media. And I think, you know, her sister didn't either. And that's their prerogative, and I'm certainly not knocking them for that. But it is an entertainment product, and I think it makes it a little bit harder when your bright, shining star who's playing this unbelievable generational golf kind of has this really limited profile and prefer to be out of the spotlight. So in general, I think, you know, to your question whether the fractious nature of the game is hurting things, I think we have to kind of trust TV ratings a little bit in that sense, and I think it is for sure. You know, Scheffler kind of gets knocked, oh, he's not as charismatic as Tiger Woods. Well, nobody is, and I actually think Scheffler is a pretty charismatic guy, and the way he plays golf is pretty spectacular. So, again, on the individual level, I see a lot of appreciation for that. Broadly speaking, I think there is a little bit of kind of like a, you know, a hollow thud that's not really resonating the way you might hope, especially if you're in our business.
Joel, speaking of people who don't really embrace golf media, Charlie Woods played a US Open qualifier last week, which was covered by almost every outlet out there. And I get that he's putting himself in a public forum by playing in a qualifier for the National Open. But is it all getting a little bit pathetic, the extent to which golf media is chasing a 15-year-old kid for clickbait?
Yeah, I think pathetic is putting it nicely. And I'm with you. I get those who assert that, hey, he's putting himself out there by getting into these events. But I would just counter that no matter where Charlie plays, people pull out their cell phones and upload videos of him to social media. So this kid, he's just going to a more formal setting that like a U.S. Open qualifier, PGA Tour qualifier. It's just the extension of the nonsense he deals with on a daily basis. To me, it's clear that fans view Charlie as an avatar for Tiger, especially as Tiger has become, you know, more and more removed from the spotlight. And, you know, maybe he will be good, but he's just 15 years old. And for a second, forget how hard it is to be the son of a celebrity, the biggest person in the sport. Just think how hard it is to be a teenager in general, you know, stuck in between these two worlds where no one really takes you seriously. So, yeah, I mean, listen, we'll find out how good he eventually is, but that's for another day. To me, golf is tough enough. Let's not make it tougher on Charlie.
Shane, I want to jump to another story that was making the rounds last week on Rory McIlroy potentially signaling interest in getting back into the board action on the PGA Tour. And leave aside the idea of, is this a popularity contest vote if the board votes him back on? Do you think there are serious governance issues here? Because we're not talking about a sleepy non-profit anymore where you've got great flexibility in terms of how you want to change things up. We're talking about a for-profit entity that has shareholders. So presumably there has to be some kind of governance on whether or not a board director who's leaving can nominate who replaces him. Is there a greater issue here, leaving aside whether or not Rory McIlroy could actually positively impact some kind of settlement in this civil war, but just how the Tour's business should be running in the future versus perhaps how it has been run in the past?
Yeah, there's definitely an issue, but I think what you're getting into a little bit is this sort of passe ethical question of how the bureaucracy should be run, when the de facto reality is the players with the most influence are running the Tour anyway, right? I mean, not completely, but they have a huge outsized influence. And so, right, whether Webb Simpson should be allowed technically to nominate his replacement, or whether Rory should be able to get back in, or whether there should be more oversight or a different kind of vote, sort of, you know, the realpolitik of it all is that Rory's a very powerful individual, and whatever method he chooses of exerting his influence, he's going to be successful at it. So I do take your point, but I don't get caught up in the details. If Rory wants to be on the board, he's going to get, you know, put on the board. If he wants to declare himself player emperor, they would probably find a way to let him declare himself player emperor. You know, the mechanisms of it are sort of irrelevant in some ways.
Sounds like the palace intrigue will continue. Two of the best scribblers for Golf Digest, Shane and Joel, we appreciate your time. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Well, one of the greatest golf resorts in the country celebrates its 25th anniversary this week. It's Bandon Dunes, Southwest Oregon. David McClay Kidd designed the eponymously named first course on the property. And after the break, he's going to tell us how a 26-year-old from Scotland with no resume and a lot of moxie got the job that changed his life. Welcome back to Golf Today. It's a special anniversary this week for this place, Bandon Dunes, famed resort on the Oregon coast, which is celebrating 25 years. Mike Kaiser had a vision, and he turned to course architect David McClay Kidd to turn it into a reality. Bandon Dunes opened in 1999 to rave reviews, and it remains one of the most highly rated links courses in the nation.
Image is a sampling of David's handiwork. Bandon Dunes, Gamble Sands, Makrahanish Dunes, been fortunate to stick a peg in the ground there just down the road from Makrahanish Old, Mammoth Dunes, St. Andrews Links, and Stonebrae Country Club. And David McClay Kidd joins us now. David, it's great to see you. Bandon Dunes celebrating a 25th anniversary this week. What do you remember when you walked onto that property for the very first time?
Am I that old already? It was July of 1994. I was a 26-year-old Scotsman with zero reputation on anything. So I walked on and thought, yeah, nobody's ever hiring me for this. But if they did, here's what I would do. And here's what I would do is what I told Mike Kaiser when I met him. I would build a classic British Isles links course with rolling greens and fescue everywhere and make everybody walk. And everybody but Mike laughed at me, and Mike said, no, that's kind of what I'm thinking too.
So as you said, 26 years old, no reputation. Was getting that job as simple as that? And are you surprised by how rapturous the reception was when the course opened in 1999?
it wasn't that simple because Mike Kaiser could hire anybody he wanted. So I realized that he probably wasn't going to hire a 26-year-old with zero resume whatsoever. Did it surprise me? Absolutely. I think it surprised even Mike Kaiser. I mean, even during the build, we were talking about whether it would be a cheeseburger or just a burger, or whether there'd be Bud and Bud Light. It was all the way through the build, it was going to be this very simple course out in Southwest Oregon that only Mike and his friends might ever come and play in, a few locals. And so the fact that it resonated with the golfing public as it did, as it has, was kind of a shock, a bit of a surprise. I mean, it wasn't following the model of golf at the time. You know, you have to walk, the weather can be rough, you're hitting off firm turf. There's all sorts of reasons why you could say this is not for me. If what you thought golf was Augusta National, Bandon Dunes is the antithesis of it.
Well, it's become the filet mignon of American golf destinations for families, friends, buddies, trips. What are you most proud of 25 years later?
Oh, that's easy, Damon. I sit at the bar at Bandon Dunes, somewhat incognito, and I listen to group after group after group coming in, and they're just giddy. You know, they're laughing, they're excited, they're teasing one another, they're high-fiving. It's just to see that effect that Bandon Dunes has on people, how it breaks them from their day-to-day lives, and they're suddenly like little kids exploring in the forest. And that for me has always been the part that gives me the greatest joy, is seeing the effect it has on people that have made that commitment to make the journey, made that commitment to put on a pair of soft shoes and hike over those sand dunes. You know, they love it. They feel like they achieved something, like they climbed a mountain and they shared it with their buddies, and it's going to be a memory they'll live with forever, even if they do it every year. So that has always been the thing I'm most proud of.
How tempting is it, David, to not tweak a golf course? Or how difficult is it not to tweak a golf course when you go back, when you see perhaps some strategy that doesn't hold up anymore, or some holes play more severely than you had imagined they would? Is it difficult to kind of edit yourself out of the process at a certain point, or do you look at it as an ongoing work of art that you are allowed to tweak constantly?
I would say I look at it as an ongoing thing. I guess there's two things that are in play for me at talking specifically about Bandon. If I heard the same gripe over and over and over, if Mike Kaiser's hearing it, then we probably need to address it. And we have. Over 25 years, there have been little tweaks and adjustments across the golf course at numerous times, responding to the feedback that we got from players. On the other side of it, in 2020, Bandon held the U.S. Amateur. And I asked Mike if I could go back and redo all of the bunkering and the surrounds to tweak some of the surrounds. That was super fun for me because with 25 years, or at that time, 20-odd years of play, I knew the holes really well. I knew where the best players went. And I also had 40,000 divots to look at on the ground and see where people were hitting shots. So I could see exactly where the best players were grouping shots. And I could move bunkers close to or even into those positions, and so make the holes a little bit more challenging for the best amateurs in the world. So that, of all of the changes I've made on courses I've done, that was probably the most fun.
David, I imagine that golf course architecture on many levels is about inspiration. Ben Crenshaw once told me he goes to Shinnecock and National on the east end of Long Island every year to kind of get his architecture juices flowing. What do you do to kind of, you know, fill that imagination and inspiration in your work?
I probably look at Ben Crenshaw's work. You know, we live in the best of times to be a golf course designer, best of times maybe to be a golfer. The peer group that I have are building exceptional projects. You can look at current projects and gain huge inspiration. I look at the work of Tom Doak and Gil Hansen, Bill and Ben, and I think to myself, and many others, and I think to myself, wow, that is so impressive. Am I capable of keeping the bar high and myself and my own team being able to rival these things? And so we continue to push. There's no mailing it in at the moment. If you're a golf course designer, you're either shooting under par or you're nowhere.
David, you've designed so many golf courses since Bandon Dunes opened, and a lot of them have been acclaimed, like Gamble Sands, like the Mammoth Dunes course at Sand Valley Resort. Is there any kind of frustration in your part that you're still kind of judged as your pinnacle design in the eyes of so many people is the very first one?
Hell no. No, they can chisel that tufted puffin into my gravestone. I'd be happy. I am never, nobody should ever apologize asking me about Bandon Dunes. I am grateful to my dying day that without Bandon Dunes, nothing else would have happened. Could I have made a successful career? Maybe, but maybe not. So Bandon Dunes gave me a launching pad that I am forever grateful for. I've told that to Mike Kaiser many times, that I'm incredibly grateful. I need nothing more of him. I could never be happier to have been involved and to constantly be part of its evolution. To be at the 25th anniversary this week with Mike how could you be happier than that?
We've often wondered, you know, how would Tiger Woods have competing against the likes of Hogan and Nelson and Snead? Any part of you wish you could have built golf courses in a different era? Was there a time that you look back on, whether it's Pete Dye or, you know, old Tom Morris, that you'd be like, wow, it'd be fun to be designing golf courses in that time period?
Well, that is a great question. And I think that, unlike a golfer, we do get to do that already. Time will judge this peer group against those guys. You know, over the next decades and millennia, there's no doubt that the courses at Bandon will get compared to the courses in Scotland or Pinehurst or wherever. Those old masters will get compared to the current group of architects who will then become those old masters. So we're already being judged against them. And as time passes, that will happen more and more. So that is one of the things, is we're trying to lay down, at least I am, that legacy, that body of work that is worthy of comparison with the best people that have ever worked in this business, which is hard to do as a golfer. You don't know if Tiger could have beat the best golfers of yesteryear.
What we also hear in the bar every night in McKee's Pub at Bandon, David, as you well know, is the comparison of where people rank the different courses. And Mike Kaiser, since hired Tom Doak, has worked out there on a couple of courses, Kerr Crenshaw as well. Is there anything you've seen on their courses subsequent to your own that makes you think, I would have done something a little bit differently 25 years ago?
Well, I did get asked once. I was doing a talk with Tom Doak, and someone in the audience said, if either of you could do anything different, what would you do? And Tom had the mic, and he gave this kind of long-winded explanation of all the little tiny tweaks and adjustments he may or may not have made had he had the opportunity to do so. And I took the mic off him, and I said, I would have just gone second. You know, going first at Bandon was busting through a lot of glass ceilings, right? You know, the no cart paths, fescue grasses, walking only, pot bunkers, the location, all the clubhouse set back from the ocean. There were so many things that Bandon did that may not have been a first, but they were nearly a first in America post-World War II. Certainly were a first then. And so when the other designers came along, that path had already been beaten, and they were able to take the path I laid and take it, you know, one step, two steps, three steps further. So if I had my perfect druthers, I'd have let Tom go first and me go second. But since he might have gone first and I might have not gone at all, then I'll take first.
I think I was in the room the day you took that microphone off Tom Doak for that one.
I think you might have been.
What has Mike Kaiser meant in this country, David, to not just to golf course architecture and the renaissance that we've seen, but to publicly accessible golf of that quality? What is Mike Kaiser's legacy in all of this?
Yeah, he is the most successful golf developer ever. in the history of the game, for sure. And I've learned so many lessons in the 30 years that I've known Mike from him. But one of the most important that's a little esoteric is Mike puts the experience of the golfer first and everything else behind that. You know, it's not about the spread of par, the solar aspect, the wind direction. You know, all of those things may be important to him, but the first and most important thing is, what is the experience that golfer is going to have? What is he going to have a good experience? And I've taken that and tried to use it and learn from it and constantly remind myself of it, that that golfer's experience is the most important. So if they play back-to-back par threes and the front nine's a 34, as long as they're having fun, it doesn't matter. You know, there's no formula that needs to be followed if that golfer is having a good time.
Can you give us a commitment here and now, David, that you will never mess with or tweak the 16th hole at Bandon?
You know, it's funny, Eamon. I have messed with the 16th hole. I messed with it right before the US Amateur. I returned a bunch of it to what was originally there. I don't think that I would ever mess with the basic fundamentals of that hole. The messing with it is probably a constant leaning back into what it was on opening day. And that could be true for all the courses at Bandon. The winters that pass move things around, and it's necessary that the resort and the architects respond to that in order to keep the courses current. If you did absolutely nothing, I'm afraid it would be in decline. You actually have to do something to keep it staying where it is, which is why the old course at St. Andrews is still being monkeyed with 600 years later.
Well, David, you brought a paintbrush to the west coast of Oregon 25 years ago, and we are all the better for it. Thanks so much for your time. Have a great time in Oregon, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you very much, guys. It's great to see you.
He is David McClay Kidd. Golf Today is back after this. Back on Golf Today, a story to put a smile on your face. A little over a week ago, 15-year-old Miles Russell put on an absolute display at the Korn Ferry Tour's Lecom Suncoast Classic, finished tied for 20th. In the process, became the youngest player to top 25 in a Korn Ferry Tour or PGA Tour event. Precocious, hits the ball a mile. Look at the youngest players to make the cut. Michelle Wee on the LPGA Tour, Guan Ting Long, back in the day, 14 years of age on the PGA Tour / DP World Tour. And there he is, Miles Russell, age 15, 5 months and 18 days. And I believe we have Miles Russell joining us on this Monday. It's great to see you, Miles. Listen, what's the most ridiculously cool thing to happen to you over these past couple of weeks?
It's been an unreal couple of weeks. It's been a blast. But, you know, I mean, to be able to hang out with some of these guys is just really cool.
I assume you went into the first week, Miles. You've played now back-to-back weeks on the Korn Ferry Tour. You went into the first week, I assume, with no pressure, because who expects a 15-year-old to play well? But when you showed up for the second tournament, did you feel as though there was a greater expectation on you?
No, I mean, I went into the second week with the same exact mindset as I went into the first week. And, you know, I played better the first week, but I didn't play bad last week and just didn't make the cut, which that's what happens in golf.
What'd you learn about yourself and your game?
I learned my golf game is, I think, good enough to compete at the next level almost. And especially when I'm playing good and whatnot. But, you know, I learned that, I kind of go with things, and I'm very comfortable playing my game, and seeing other guys' game might be hitting it 30 by me, but I just try to stick to my game. I learned that I can do that.
You've got a start coming up then on the PGA Tour with the Butterfield Bermuda Championship a little bit later this summer. Do you have a sense of where you think the most headroom exists for your game to take that move to the next level?
No, I think I just keep doing what I'm doing and putting in the hours, putting in the practice, and kind of see where that puts us.
What about outside the ropes, Brawl Stars or 2K or Fortnite? I mean, you're in the sweet spot of your teenage years. What do you do in your downtime away from the golf course?
You know, I'll play some tennis and pickleball with my sister. I go fishing every once in a while, but it's mainly schoolwork. Got to try to stay ahead and to be able to go and plan these things and take the week off.
What's the plan for school versus golf? Where's the balance existing at that stage for you right now, Miles?
Well, I mean, I think a typical day will be I do a little schoolwork in the morning and then kind of get dropped off at the course. Then at night when it's dark out, I'll go and bust out a lot more schoolwork, kind of keep it balanced. But I definitely probably do a little more golf than school, which is nice.
I was struck by something you said in the past couple of weeks about your process when you're going to a driving range to hit balls. See a lot of players with AirPods on, maybe they're listening to some music, getting ready for a round, and you don't like the AirPods, and I'm curious why.
You know, I don't like wearing them because I feel like I like to hear what's going on and hear the contact that the ball is making to the club. I think that's a big thing. You have to know when you hit it good, but you also got to know what it sounds like when you hit it good. So I think when you have AirPods or just some sort of headphones with music playing, you kind of miss that sound that you can make when you hit a good one. Especially helps when you're not hitting it great, right? Because that ball, that contact is not the same. But like if you can get that one good one when you're not hitting it well and it makes that sound, I think it could kind of get you in a little bit of a rhythm almost.
You spent some time recently around a guy who seems to hit it well every week out there, Scotty Scheffler. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, to be able to walk one there at TPC with him. I mean, just to kind of pick his brain and figure, like, kind of learn from him, it was really cool. Yeah, I mean, he's just such a great guy, too.
Did he give any advice?
He did. He, I think the best piece was kind of just keep doing what I'm doing and just be me. That was really cool because, I mean, coming from somebody like that, that's that's an amazing thing for them to say.
How's your life changed over the last couple of weeks? Much different? More text messages? More phone calls? What's been different?
Last week it was a busy week. Definitely got a couple more text messages than usual, but nothing's really changed. I'm still just doing it for fun and doing something I love.
Miles Russell, remember the name. I'm a big fan of the name and of you. Congrats on all your accomplishments. Hope to speak to you down the road.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
15-year-old phenom, Miles Russell. Say it loud for the people in the back. We're back after this. Take you back to last year's JM Eagle LA Championship at Wilshire Country Club. Australia's Hannah Green made a 25-foot birdie on the final hole to join a three-way playoff. She would go on to par the second extra hole to win the event for her first LPGA win since September of 2019. And fast forward to Sunday, after speaking to us earlier in the week on Golf Today, 5-under round of 66, second lowest round on another tricky day in Los Angeles, etched her name into the Wilshire Country Club history book by successfully defending her title at the JM Eagle LA Championship, earning her fourth straight top three finish at the historic course. With her second LPGA win of the season, she's thinking about the rest of the year.
Looking ahead, I mean, we've got the Olympic Games. This kind of solidifies your spot there for Australia. Is that something and a goal that you had in your mind at the start of this year?
Yeah, a little bit. I didn't have a great season last year. Even though I did win here in LA, I actually had my most inconsistent year. So to obviously already win in Singapore and then win here this week, I hope that I can get closer to my goal of being in the top 10 in the world and, solidify my spot in the Olympics.
Let's take a look at the top five moments of joy presented by FootJoy. History was made on the Corn Ferry Tour Thursday by Frankie Sapin, 13 under par, 58 in the first round of the Veritex Bank Championship. He became the second player to shoot that number, but he didn't even realize it.
What was?
Pretty good, wasn't it?
What was that? What was that? What was that? Total baller move from Sapin. This is a pretty cool story. Tommy Fleetwood finished tied for third at the Masters, teed it up at the RBC Heritage on Hilton Head Island, and then was on the bag this past week for his stepson, Oscar Craig, on the Challenge Tour. The 17-year-old made his first cut, and Tommy took the social to brag about his stepson. Very, very cool.
This was a pretty cool moment as well. First round of the Zurich Classic of New Orleans. Rookie of the Year, Eric Cole, on the par 3 14th from 207 yards. It's the eighth hole-in-one of the Zurich Classic since it became a team event in 2017. Playing alongside his teammate, Russ Cochran, who became the 71st player with 600 or more starts.
How about number two? Yeah, Brandon Dune celebrating a birthday. How about Stephen Ames of the Mitsubishi Electric Classic? Started there with the cake for his 60th birthday, got serenaded out on the course, and the icing on the cake, shot 67 to defend his title and pick up his eighth PGA Tour champs win.
And number one on the list, making their debut appearance as teammates at the Zurich Classic of New Orleans, Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry picked up the win and celebrated in style. Don't stop believing, right, Rory?
Yeah, picked up the win, then picked up Rory. Want you to get involved as well? We put this out on social media. What makes you hashtag feel the joy on the course? And we got some answers. Norman says, watching a friend play their personal best. We got James saying, switching off my phone for the duration of the round. Life can wait for 3 to 4 hours.
See, that's the exact opposite of me. I take great joy in the misery of my friends and tweeting about it while it's happening. So I'm on the other side of both of those guys.
Yeah, the phone distracts me. And I tell you what, we had an old school conversation with David McClay Kidd. You want to talk about old school, walking the golf course, feeling the terra firma beneath your feet as Bannon celebrates a 25th birthday.
He is a fascinating guy. I've spent a lot of time with David over the years and had conversations similar to what we had today. What's easy to forget, we look at all the beauty shots of Bandon Dunes now. That place was choked with gorse bushes when he went out there. So he was literally finding a golf course in the middle of terrain that didn't look that hospitable as it does now.
Special place, also special, the PGA Professional Championship follows us. Enjoy your Monday. We will see you tomorrow.